This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As far back as the 1960s, opinions hardened on a series of issues. The Vietnam War, the role of women, on race, abortion, the environment. Over the decades that followed, some fronts closed, new ones opened, like gay marriage, and the culture wars raged on. Then-candidate and now President Barack Obama declared that it's past time for a truce. He vows to listen respectfully to all sides, and he's already made some important gestures. He went to George Will's house for dinner with conservative commentators. He visited Republicans on Capitol Hill, even hosted a bipartisan Super Bowl party. But while gestures may help, it will not be easy to resolve differences of principle, differences of philosophy, bitter memories, and old habits. Recently, though, Peter Beinart wrote a piece called The End of the Culture Wars that suggests that Barack Obama may be the right man in the right spot at the right time, and he'll join us in just a moment. Later in the hour, Christine Brennan on Michael Phelps' infamous bong hit, and we'll remember the third passenger on Buddy Holly's plane. But first, the culture wars. Is it time for a truce? And if so, where are you willing to compromise? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. You can just click on Talk of the Nation. Peter Beinart is a senior fellow for U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. The End of the Culture Wars appeared on the Daily Beast. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And you're right, when it comes to culture, Obama doesn't have a public agenda as much as a public anti-agenda. What do you mean by that?
I think Obama would like to diminish the role that cultural conflict plays in American politics. By cultural conflict, I mean politics that is primarily about identity, not about the distribution of economic resources or about America's role in the world. I think he believes that that has been a source of enormous polarization, much more heat than light in American politics. And I think he would like to kind of ease the friction on some of those issues as part of his effort to actually get a lot done in the other realms of American politics.
And two things that work in his favor, you argue, are his youth and his race.
Yes. As others have pointed out, the fact that Barack Obama is the first president of a post-baby boom generation is quite significant, that some have described the culture war as a generational struggle amongst baby boomers, amongst people who lived through the turbulent events of the 1960s, between those who thought they were basically good for America and those who thought they were basically bad. Whereas the polling shows that younger Americans, by and large, even if they may differ on issues, don't have as much intensity on those set of issues. And Obama is the now embodiment of that younger generation. On race, what's interesting is that although race still makes up part of what the culture war is about, I think that if you look over the last couple of decades, the culture war has been becoming less about race and more about religion. And the interesting thing about Barack Obama as an African American is that one thing that conservative white evangelicals have to acknowledge is that African Americans and Barack Obama himself are deeply religious. And in that way, I think they are better. He is better suited to bridging the culture war than a white Democrat who would be perceived, rightly or wrongly, like John Kerry or Michael Dukakis, as very secular.
And your piece caused a lot of controversy, as I'm sure you know. And some people have said, now, wait a minute, Barack Obama doesn't want to bridge these controversies. He wants to end the culture wars by winning it.
Well, there's some truth in that, and I think I did actually acknowledge that in the piece. But there are areas where Democrats, and Obama in particular, have given ground. On gun control, for instance, that is not part of the Democratic agenda at all. Even on gay marriage, Barack Obama is not for gay marriage, although many of his supporters are. He supports civil unions. And I think Barack Obama is part of a movement in the Democratic Party to try to say, look, we want abortion to remain legal, but we would like to work to reduce the number of abortions. Because we agree with you in the anti-abortion movement that an abortion is, in fact, a tragedy.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Doug Kamek. He is chair and professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, with us today from the studios, their studios in Malibu, California. It's snowing here in Washington, Doug. You can be proud of that.
Mm. I won't say anything about our weather, Neil. Nice to be with you.
Nice to talk with you again. And you have found yourself, to some degree, Doug Kamek, on the front edge of this conversation. You are well known as a conservative legal scholar. You are a long battler in the anti-abortion movement. You then, however, crossed the line to work with Barack Obama in the last election. And I know you said you even talked to him about this very issue.
I did, and indeed it was this very issue, Neil, that Peter writes about that prompted me to cross the bridge. It was his expression in our meetings and in other places of the simple idea that we have a stake in one another and that what binds us together is simply greater than what drives us apart, and that if enough people come to believe in the truth of that proposition, we can get some meaningful work done. We might not be able to solve every problem, but we can make progress. And as Peter writes in his piece, this is a way of certainly ameliorating the culture war, if not ending it, because in many ways he transcends it. He transcends it in not only by saying in his politics, I'm not going to engage in identity politics and wedge politics, but as Peter knows, and as others have written, that in his very identity, he's both black and white. He has influences of Christianity and Muslim thought. He does transcend the baby boom era. He's been on both sides of the bridge. But even more importantly than that is that he doesn't see these things as just partisan issues. He understands what binds the country together in times where it is important for us to come together to deal with problems such as health care, deal with problems such as immigration, to avoid the polarization that radical individualism causes. And he's remarkable in that respect. And he conveyed this very much in the meetings we had in the summer to even people who were directly opposed to him on many policy grounds.
And among them, you on the issue of abortion in particular. And you also know that you were pilloried by some in the pro-life movement for what they regarded as being a traitor.
Well, and exactly right, because one of the things that I gave him all of the arguments that I would give as a Catholic scholar against abortion, including the belief that it is categorically, intrinsically wrong. And he answered those not by disagreeing, but by pointing out that there is a place of common ground where the two of us can work to reduce abortion, where we can recognize that it is a tragic moral choice and that there are causes for what prompts especially a poor woman without shelter, without adequate care, without prenatal support, to make that choice. And at that moment, as I watched, as he went around the room and he did the same thing to every person who raised issues about employment, about health care, about the environment, each time I finally said to him, I get it. The founders of our country perceived the human person and human nature as distinctly negative. The human person was to be watched. Power was not to be used for the common good. You've got a supposition that the human person is basically good and that you can harness power toward that achievement.
Yet we don't want to make this a show about abortion or changes in the pro-life movement. We did a show on that, and that caused enough controversy at the time anyway. But I did want to ask you, there will be those who will not see any movement here, who will not be able to compromise one little bit.
Well, that's right. And of course, they live on the blogs, and it's not a very friendly place. And indeed, one of the things that the president has to work every day against is the forces that want to keep identity politics alive, that want to keep picking at the sore points, that want to illustrate the negative rather than the positive, to not see that there can be progress on abortion, with respect to same-sex marriage, with respect to gun control, with respect to race relations and so forth, but rather want to just see where in which we can never agree as a matter of principle. And those individuals, of course, have to make me and others like me who have come to the side of President Obama a target, because those who are willing to say that a common ground is possible are worse than the enemy. They are ones who are seeking to compromise principle, as our opponents would see it.
And not just the blogs, but other media too, including talk radio. But Peter Beinart, it's not just on the right that you're going to have people saying, we're not ready to compromise. We won the election on the left, and this is our time. We should get our messages through. We should win all the fights on labor rights and other kinds of things.
No, in fact, you see this, I think, interestingly played out in the appointment of Kirsten Gillibrand to be the new United States Senator from New York. She represents an upstate, fairly rural district, and she is anti-gun control. Anyone who thinks a pro-gun control Democrat could win in that district is frankly out of their mind. And I think it was very wise of the of Governor Patterson and other Democrats to appoint someone like that to show, in fact, that there's diversity in the Democratic Party. Just as I think the Democrats were wise to support the candidacy of Bob Casey, who's against abortion, to be a senator from Pennsylvania, to show, in fact, that the Democratic Party, even though it has certain ideas in its platform, is a big tent. First of all, that's the way you win elections. But I think it's also it's also the way that you show respect to people of other views. And I think that has produced a great deal of controversy. And I think her future will be an interesting indicator of how open, in fact, the Democratic Party is.
Because there's already been an indication that a congresswoman from Long Island who's been very prominent in favor of gun control may challenge her in the primary just on that one issue.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it'll be very interesting. And as you look ahead, Doug Kamek, the symbolism of the two preachers that we saw at the inauguration. Again, this is something that caused some bitterness on the left, but is it more than a symbol to the right?
Oh, you know, I think the symbolism of religion is that Barack Obama understands that, again, religion is not something that ought to be used for purposes of division. He understands that there are different voices in the religious community, but that its benefit is that which gives us a kind of civic Republican spirit and can bring us together. That's what he was doing by making those inclusions.
We're trying to talk about common ground today and maybe the prospect of a truce, maybe a ceasefire, at least on some fronts in the culture wars. If you think that's a good thing, where would you be willing to compromise a little bit? If any place, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We mentioned the 1960s. Some trace the start of the culture wars in America to the 1920s. The tensions came from shifts in popular culture, differences in values between urban and rural areas. Well, others say, no, it was the 1960s, the counterculture, the anti-war movement, whenever it began. Today, we're focused on an end to the culture war, whether President Obama may be in a position to do that. Is it time for a truce? If so, where are you? Might you be willing to compromise? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation at our website, too. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Peter Beinart, who wrote The End of the Culture Wars for the Daily Beast, and Doug Kamek, who served as legal counsel in the administrations of President Ronald Reagan and President George H.W. Bush. And let's see if we can get some callers on the line. And let's go to Tom. Tom with us from New Haven.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Neil.
Go ahead, Tom.
Originally being from San Francisco, having a lot of homosexual friends, gay marriage is a huge issue out there, obviously. And I think as long as these couples are given the same exact rights, no legal distinction, the title of gay marriage could be compromised as a civil union. But the many people out there will never, ever, in their wildest dreams, ever concede that.
And not just in San Francisco, but you personally would be willing to say, all right, if you call it civil unions, if it abrogates no rights that you would get in marriage, what's in a name, we'll live with it.
Absolutely. I mean, if we could just put this whole thing to bed and move on with more important and, economic and foreign policy issues, I think it would be fantastic for our country. But my fear is that it's going to continue for many years to come.
Peter Beinart?
I understand why people think that the symbolism of marriage matters so much. I actually happen to think it matters a lot as well. I might consider myself a fervent believer not merely in civil unions, but in fact in gay marriage, which I very much hope and believe is America's destiny. I think it's very, very hard, and I think it's worth stating, when you are not of a historically disenfranchised group yourself, to say, well, these people should wait. They should leave their concerns because we have other bigger fish to fry. That's a very, very difficult thing to say. But I do think one can say this, that there are times when moving too fast and creating a political backlash can set back the cause. I'm not sure that Bill Clinton's, for instance, decision to do gays in the military right at the beginning of his administration in 1993, even though I fervently believe that gays should be able to serve openly in the military, actually did the cause of gay rights a lot of good. And I think so the more measured way that Barack Obama is handling that issue, for instance, and the care that we need to take to make sure that judicial decisions on gay marriage don't produce the kind of electoral backlash that in fact leads us to have laws that set back the cause of gay marriage, I think those are really appropriate things to think about.
Or constitutional state amendments.
Exactly.
There's been a whole bunch of those.
Exactly.
Doug Kamek, would, from the vantage point of the right, would civil unions be seen as a compromise?
Well, I've actually done some writing on this, and I think it is a compromise. And one of the real problems out here with Proposition 8 is that it has become an all-or-nothing proposition. You either fully subscribe to gay marriage or you don't, whereas some of us have argued that maybe the solution is complete equality among all citizens of California, but the only thing that the state would provide would to either heterosexual or gay couples would be a civil union license, and that historically the concept, the sacramental concept even of marriage, has been a religious one, and leave it up to the churches then in their individual doctrines and practices to decide whether or not same-sex marriage as a concept would exist. This is a way that some of us have been urging the legislature to get reinvolved and the governor to get reinvolved to create this equality of civil unions for all people in California and to preserve the religious freedom of the individual churches, rather than leave it up to litigation, which is going to lead one side a winner and one side a loser, which is the opposite of the common ground effort, I think, that the president is trying to pursue.
So if it's a religious difference, argue it out in religious circles, and then we'd all learn how to pronounce schism.
I think that's right.
Tom, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you, Neil.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to Troy. Troy with us from Iowa City.
Yes, I got a quick question here. What exactly view has Obama taken to agree with the Republicans? I don't understand. He really is a Democrat. He takes the Democratic views because the only one is maybe gay marriage and maybe respect for being a pedophile next.
I'm sorry.
Well, gay
rights. I get that. This is
gay
the
rights is next.
No, this is the theory that if
why couldn't be a pedophile be next?
No, I understand. This is the argument, the slippery slope argument, that if you allow homosexuals, people of the
exactly.
same sex, to marry,
and
then
homosexual.
I understand, Troy.
It's like being a pedophile.
No, it's not like being a pedophile, Troy, but I accept the purpose of your argument. Doug Kamek, can you give us some examples from your point of view? You did earlier, but if you would reemphasize, where you think President Obama is reaching out to cultural conservatives?
Well, we have mentioned some already, such as his efforts to work into the political platform of the Democrats, efforts to reduce abortion, and I assume that will be backed up with efforts in terms of legislation. His approach to equality in terms of homosexual persons, but not support for gay marriage. His recognition that some appropriate level of there is a constitutional right. He's acknowledged under the Second Amendment to the right to bear arms, but it's subject to reasonable gun control. One can say all of those are at least moderate Republican positions. But, even more importantly than that, Neil, is that I think Obama's sophistication and intelligence on this transcends the usual political labels. He understands that what our history has often been about, as the author Robert Bella has mentioned, is a cyclical contest between individual freedom on the one hand, which is nourished at times when things are good, and coming together in solidarity as a community when we really need to address problems that individualism causes. And so, for example, I think this is, it's not a Republican or Democratic issue to allow extensive amounts of poverty or the polarization of income or a health system that leaves tens of millions of people without insurance or environmental policy that not only fails to lead the world to greater sustainability, but actually in the past 8 years stood in the way of that sustainability. It seems to me both parties have to be for addressing the poor, for addressing the needs of people without insurance, for addressing the needs of the environment. And it's a question of recognizing how we can come together to accomplish those objectives rather than to say there's one list, list A for the Republicans and list B for the Democrats.
But to be fair, there are conservatives who argue the dismissal of the Bush administration official who was in charge of running the AIDS program in Africa, widely seen as perhaps the best thing in the Bush administration by many people, that was a bowing down to pressures on the left, that the president's decision to sign a legislation or executive order on the second day that would reverse the decision to provide funding for birth control groups that provide abortions, that those things are not very graceful gestures to the right.
Well, it's not a perfect system, and President Obama is not one who's going to resign his party membership. So we're realistic about that as well. When we say we can find common ground, it doesn't mean that our differences totally evaporate. They will remain. And one of the things that I think, for example, on Mexico City, we learned was that even though I opposed the timing of that as well as its reversal, I also now have a better grasp of the health needs that prohibition was leaving unmet. And one of the things that I think going forward by virtue of that discussion is that we will be able to work together to meet those health needs without getting abortion entangled in that discussion.
Peter?
I think I am not a conservative, but it seems to me if one looks at this from the point of view of a conservative and the culture wars, one also has to ask the question, how well were conservatives doing during the Bush administration? How much did they actually get from Republican governance? I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that, in fact, it was a fairly radical kind of libertarian economic agenda that was pursued, and conservatives, evangelicals and other social conservatives were taken for granted. If you believe that there are cultural forces, certainly on an issue like gay rights, that I think are pushing America in a more liberal direction, I think that the position of simply voting for a Republican Party that is losing on some of these culture war issues, has not been a very productive place to be. And I think that's why it's so valuable that there are evangelicals and other social conservatives who are broadening out and thinking about new kinds of strategies for getting to the kind of society that they would like to live in.
Let's talk to Michael. Michael with us from Fayette. Is this in Alabama?
Yes, sir, where unfortunately so-called Christian talk radio, although I'm an evangelical Christian, is the only kind of journalism too many people get in the rural Southeast. I have two questions. I'll try to make the first one as quick as possible, then I'll hang up on the second one. There are some beautiful, splendid, outstanding examples, just like your wonderful guest, of people coming together, usually outside of government, to have solutions on their own that can either silence or shame into silence both the ultra-left and the ultra-right. I've seen an episode of Little House on the Prairie from the first 1974-75 NBC season when all the children got together to make a bell for the church. That's a good example of this, and might have been about the House Un-American Activities Committee, the underlying theme of the plot, I don't know. And one area where I think this could be put to good use to quell both the left and the right in this country is immigration. There are countless other examples, but I've heard so much anti-immigrant rhetoric on so-called Protestant, that's what it largely is, talk radio,
mm-hmm.
Not because they have anti-Catholic bias now, but because of the underlying public that the Christian right and the Republicans tried to entreat to join in the 1970s with their Southern strategy. Okay.
And very quickly, if you would, Michael.
Okay. I'm sorry. I guess I'm trying to get my words together. Instead of blaming the victims, why don't we actually create jobs in the Third World in general, but in Afghanistan in particular, which is another subject, and in Mexico, especially the southern states, and in Central America, where they're trying to build up their infrastructure for tourism, but soldiering, I found out on public TV, is the only thing too many of these adult males know, especially in El Salvador and Nicaragua. We have the infrastructure to do that, the child sponsorship charities, the religious and the secular charities. All we need is the funding, and we one infrastructure from Washington, the Peace Corps. All we need is extra funding from Washington, not only there, but in Afghanistan especially, not just Washington, but Western Europe, all the promises we made to Afghanistan,
Michael.
And in Haiti, both Washington and the French government owe Haiti big time
Michael.
For the sins they committed against Haiti in the 1920s. That can prevent having small businesses, the women having sewing machines,
Michael.
The girls going to school, to prevent child sexual slavery traffic, there being...
Michael, this is getting pretty global right now,
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I just wondered what he thinks about solutions like that, where the infrastructures are already in place, but getting rid of the problem
sometimes
sources.
Sometimes more easily said than done, Michael. But thanks very much for the suggestion.
Thanks.
We appreciate the call. We're talking about, well, perhaps an end to the culture wars. You're listening to the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter Beinart, at this point, exporting American jobs. Getting back to his point on immigration, this is pretty interesting. People feared it would be a wedge issue in the last election. For the most part, it was not.
Yes, but I do think there is still the great possibility that immigration could reignite the culture wars. I mean, to go back to the 1920s, immigration was really at the center of the culture wars of the 1920s, and prohibition was very much an issue about anti-Catholicism in the 1920s. I think America is in the midst of a massive cultural and demographic shift as the result of the post-1965 immigration, particularly in this time of economic downturn. It's not hard to imagine that we could have a rising illegal immigrant and even rising legal immigrant demagoguery. And I think that it's interesting that Obama has actually, I think, basically tried to put that issue on the back burner. He has not taken up immigration reform as one of his central issues, which I think is wise. But I think there is that great danger out there. And I think that George W. Bush deserves some credit, it seems to me, for trying to make the Republican Party basically a pro-immigrant, non-democratic
party. And John McCain, for that
matter. And John McCain, absolutely. But ultimately, I think where the Republican Party, I hope, will go is not simply to support people coming to the United States as workers, but to support them coming as possible citizens. So we don't have a kind of guest worker, second class, because I think that will simply perpetuate the economic and cultural conflict in the country.
Let's get to this email from Leo in Manchester, New Hampshire. We would do well to remember the so-called culture wars did not just happen. They are the outgrowth of Nixon's Southern strategy, Agnew's attacks on the press and intellectuals. By the 1990s, the GOP had honed this strategy by virtually becoming the party of the religious right. Mr. Obama's attempt to be bipartisan is laudable, but I fear Republicans form up behind Rush Limbaugh and Sarah Palin. Cultural rapprochement will be a long time coming. And the fact of the matter is, not meaning to put an argument in Leo's mouth that isn't there, but you could make similar, people on the right could make similar points about going back to the New Deal and various other times. But the fact of the matter, Doug Kamek, a lot of this depends on the new direction of the Republican Party.
It does. It depends on the willingness of the Republican Party to identify people who can see that there is a common basis on which agreement can be found. That the Republican Party is not just everyone for themselves, a kind of a total libertarianism, but in fact that it's a respect for individual freedom, but recognizing that there's a place for government. And the place for government is where individuals cannot do for themselves. And that's why President Obama, I think, has struck the right tone on this, in almost every practical sense. When he talks about his faith-based initiative, for example, in response to your previous caller, he's not overlooking the fact that great things can be done by small groups and individuals. Indeed, those are the most important things. Those are the things he appreciates the most by virtue of his community organizing background. And so one of the first things that the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives will do will be to make sure that the smallest possible group has the technical capacity to take advantage of the public resources it would need to accomplish its goals without at the same time diminishing that individual initiative.
Doug Kamek, thanks so much for your time today.
Neil, great to be with you.
Doug Kamek, Chair and Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine University, with us today from the studios at Pepperdine in Malibu, California. I'm sure it's snowing there, too. And also with us, Peter Beinart, Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington, D.C. He wrote the article, The End of the Culture Wars, for the Daily Beast. Thanks very much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Olympian Michael Phelps' photo finish, not in the pool, but with the bong. Should we hold celebrity athletes to a higher standard? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Christine Brennan will join us in just a moment. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.